welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price. I'm joined by Chad Bird and Brandon Hansen. Fellas, how you doing?
Hey, we're good. Hope everybody out there is doing good too.
It's a beautiful morning in New York. I couldn't complain.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we'll take care of, pitches for you to donate and conference announcement stuff at the end so you don't forget about it. And we'll just jump right in. Chad, where are we at?
So last time we spent a couple of episodes talking about chapter 37 in Genesis, which is the introduction of the story of Joseph. And we finished chapter 37 last time. So we're right here at the beginning of chapter 38, but we have a surprise because you would think, well, chapter 37 ends with Joseph in Egypt. He's taken down there after being betrayed by his brothers, and he's sold into slavery, into the household of one of Pharaoh's officers, a guy named Potiphar. And you would think, this being a narrative, that the story would just kind of pick up there with Joseph and tell us what happened to him. But it's like chapter 38 is like a very long commercial break. You know, you're watching this program, you're taken right to this exciting scene, and all of a sudden they cut to commercial. Or better yet, it's like a to be continued. So chapter 38 is a to be continued interlude between what happened with Joseph in the past and what's going to happen with him in the future. And it really, it's as far as narrative technique, it's sort of creating suspense, I guess you could say, because it takes us to that point, then it makes us wait. But it also does something else because, so we're told all about Joseph in chapter 37. And in chapter 38, we're going to be told all about Judah, as well as Tamar and some other characters. But I think one of the reasons that the book was set up this way is that you could kind of compare and contrast what was going on. So we know what happened with Joseph. We know what his brothers did to him. And now in chapter 38, we're going to hear a little bit about what his brothers were up to while he was a slave in Egypt. So we got the Joseph story introduced, and now we're going to have this interlude that tells us all about his older brother, Judah, and all of the shenanigans that he was up to back in the homeland.
Yeah, and this is Judah who ends up with the blessing.
This is Judah, right? This is Judah who ends up with a blessing.
But to find
because
out,
he was such a holy man.
But to find out how righteous this dude is.
Yeah, this is all about Judah's righteousness. And we'll just see how righteous
he's
dude
crushing
he was.
It. He's crushing it on the horizontal righteousness.
Oh, thing. Man, yeah, this guy. I mean, this really is is the model of piety for us to follow here. Or not. By the time you read the chapter we're about to go over, you are disabused of any notions of some kind of great holiness and righteousness and piety that Judah exhibited. Because, I guess we'll find out. If you don't know the story already, buckle your seatbelt because you're in for a ride. So here's what happens. The chapter begins by saying, and it came about at that time. All right, so that's our link to what happened with Joseph. So Joseph's in Egypt, he's a slave, and Judah, he departs from his brothers, and he goes to visit a friend of his, a guy named Hira. And while he's there, he spots this girl. She's a Canaanite, so this is not, you know, from his own kin, as they tended to be in the past. This is somebody outside, so this is a Gentile. And I was reading Luther's commentary in this chapter this morning, and Luther makes a huge point about the fact that Christ traces his genealogy from the Gentiles, because as we'll see in just a minute, the woman that ends up being a mother in the line is a Gentile. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So first of all, Judah, he sees this Canaanite girl, and we don't even know her name, just know her dad's name. His name was Shua, and he marries her. He takes her in, and the Bible is so blunt about this. He went into her, so the marriage was consummated, and she gets pregnant. And there follows the birth of three sons. You got and then you got second Onan, and then the youngest was Shelah. So he has Judah now has these three sons with the daughter of Shua. And I might mention now before I forget it, it's kind of fascinating the connections that the scriptures often have, the kind of the web that is woven between various narratives, because this woman that Judah marries, later she's called Bathshua. And it just so happens that the woman that David ended up with, Bathsheba, is also a variant name that she has is Bathshua. So there's only two Bathshuas in the Bible, and it just so happens that Judah married one and David married the other. Now make of that what you want, but it's an interesting connection between these two guys, especially since David was of the lineage of Judah. So back to the story. Judah marries her. They have three sons together. But things did not go well in Judah's household. First of all, he finds a wife. He finds a wife for his firstborn son. His firstborn son was named Ur. And this wife is named Tamar. So we're introduced to her in verse 6, and she and Judah then become the central characters in this sordid story that follows. Now, things did not go well for Ur. We don't know what he did, but we're told that he was Judah's firstborn, and he was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord took his life. So one down. Then we have a problem. A family problem, a societal problem, cultural problem, whatever you want to call it, because there was no child that was born to the union of Ur and Tamar, Judah's firstborn son and the wife that he picked out for him. And so we're introduced in verse 8 to a practice that was actually pretty widespread, not just among the Israelites, but among other cultures as well. So it's often referred to as the leveret marriage. So here's the deal. Dan, you got brothers, right? Right.
I do.
So, all right. So I can't remember. Are you the oldest or not?
I am.
You're the oldest. All right. So if you married back in these days and you didn't have a son, and something happened to you, there's an accident, you died, then it would be the obligation of your brother, your next brother, next oldest brother, to take your widow as his own wife and to father children with her. But the deal was that the children that that they had together would not be your brother's children, they would be your children. And they would inherit your name as well as any blessing or inheritance that had been promised to you. So here's the deal in Judah's household. His oldest dies. There's no son with Ur. And so it falls on Onan's shoulders to marry Tamar and to father children through her. Now, I might point out that often people discuss the legitimacy of polygamy and the place of polygamy in the Bible. Well, I don't think you can get around the fact that polygamy was established, at least some form of polygamy was established by God, because this became part of the law of Moses later on in Deuteronomy. That, if a guy already has a wife and his older brother dies, then he's required to marry his brother's widow. And if he doesn't, it's like he disgraces himself. The widow can spit in his face and slap him with her sandal. So it's a disgraceful thing not to do this. So, in this instance, anyway, in the case of leveret marriage, polygamy was not only allowed, but actually commanded. He, was supposed to take his deceased brother's widow, even if he had a wife already.
Yeah, yeah. That's always an awesome conversation when someone asks me about that.
About polygamy?
Yeah, and you're like, well, like culturally speaking, I don't think it's a good idea, but You know, and it's illegal here, so don't do it. But in reality, God has ample opportunity to condemn it.
Yeah, he does, and doesn't.
And it's weird, but they like so right there, it's like commanded. But you have other instances, and this is like people are gonna think this podcast is getting real weird now. Nobody here is trying to like have multiple wives, okay?
Yeah, we're not going all Mormon on. No, we promise.
All right. But and just so you know how biblically faithful we are, the truth is, I mean, there's other passages where God seems to take credit for such things. I mean, he tells David, like, I gave you all of Saul's wives, like, as if it was him that did it. You know, it says, like, Gideon was blessed because he had many sons and many wives. And you're like, oh, it's like there's many times where it's talked about in a very positive light, and so like, and so you're, it's not like, and Gideon, God loved him in spite of the fact that he had many sons, for he had many wives, and like God somehow was disapproving of this. It's you'd be hard pressed, man, to show that this was something that God was like upset about.
Yeah, yeah, quite the opposite, as the examples that you brought up prove. This was often symbolic of the blessing that God lavished upon someone. So no, we're not saying go out if you're married and find a second or third wife. No, quite the contrary. That's never a good idea.
Well, you do also see where, I mean, there are problems with it that are evident in many of the narratives.
Yeah, that's kind of the unspoken message that you have. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the two wives of Jacob, or all the problems that David had later on. I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's a bad idea, and yet it was done over and over. Isaac's the only patriarch who didn't have more than one wife. All the kings had multiple wives. Many of the judges did as well. So you simply can't produce an argument from scripture that says that all of this polygamy was displeasing to the Lord. In fact, in the case of the levirate marriage, quite the opposite. God was not pleased when a brother refused to marry the widow of his deceased brother if no children had been produced from that earlier union.
And this is also like, there's also a compassion thing there. I mean, like, so say a guy that was married hooked up with some girl that wasn't married, he was then obligated to marry her and like pay her father and all this kind of stuff, because, and this is put in place because nobody else gonna want her, and like, so what's she gonna do? And in the case of your husband dying and the brother coming in, like, you're talking about a culture where it wasn't like, well, I'll just go down and get a job and everything will be there. That's not really an option here.
Yeah, there was no safety net for widows and orphans. I mean, they're the two groups that are held up over and over and over as the most disenfranchised of society. Those are the most, you know, they're the ones that have nobody to protect them unless they go back to their, you know, in the case of widows, they go back to their parents if they're still alive. But yeah, this was about not only fathering children for the deceased, but it was also about showing compassion to those who had nowhere else to go.
Yeah, that's why in those, like, the instance I brought up, where if you went and, you know, hooked up with somebody that wasn't your wife, like, well, she's gonna be now, I think this is how it works. You're either gonna marry her or else you're gonna die. Yeah. Like, those are the options.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're going to marry her, or you're going to pay some kind of penalty for it, one way or another. So, yeah. I mean, we can't read our modern notions of sexuality and marriage and all of this stuff into the Old Testament. We have to accept it the way it is, and it's very different from what we often assume, as we see in this case here. So, kind of put yourself in Onan's shoes here. He's the second son. Now, if he does what he's supposed to do and he fathers children through Tamar, then basically those children are going to receive the inheritance of the firstborn and Onan's not. But if Onan does not father children through Tamar, then he's next in line to receive the double blessing of the firstborn. So there's a couple things going, a couple of motives going on for what we see he's about to do, because it says that, this is verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. So he purposely avoids any possibility, or at least not any possibility, but in his eyes anyway, he's trying to do everything he can not to get her pregnant. Notice that he didn't hesitate to have sex with her, though. He just didn't want to chance impregnating her and thus losing what he wanted. So he wanted the sex, that was fine, but he also wanted the inheritance that came from being now the de facto firstborn who had received the blessing. So that might have seemed like a good idea to Onan, but God was not happy whatsoever. Verse 10, what he did was displeasing to the Lord. So he took his life too. These poor guys. So two sons are down. Ur was evil. God killed him. Onan refused to father children for his dead brother. So he ended up dead too. Things are not looking very positive in the household of Judah.
All right, this is about to get PG-13 up in here if it already hasn't.
I think it already has. I mean, yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. I mean, the Bible, God, there's certain things that you would not expect the Bible to talk about so graphically. You know, very few people realize, I suspect, that the Bible has a verse that talks about ejaculating on the ground. But there it is, you know, it's right there in black and white. So,
I was gonna give a personal story here.
That's too personal.
That's a segue.
We can edit this out if you guys vote me down after this story.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember, and I think this comes to bear because people have brought up this passage before. I remember sitting in a youth group. That it was all guys, like a guys youth group thing, and like this youth pastor saying that he used this story to get here, and he said, "Hey, this is why if you masturbate, God might strike you dead."
Oh yes,
and
right.
I'm not saying, hey, everybody should, you know, hey, masturbation is like a wonderful thing that everybody should participate in. But what I am saying is I don't think that this is what this text is about.
No. Nor is it about birth control
right away.
There's only one place that seed belongs, and if it goes anywhere else, like, you know, I mean, because people...
Then God will strike you dead.
Well, people will use this as an argument against contraception and...
It's called Onanism. Yeah, it's named after Judah's second son. Yeah, Onanism. That's doing something with your seed that you're not supposed to.
That, well, and all of that, you know, all of that may be sin, but well, I don't think contraception is sin, sorry, but just how I roll. But yeah, the rest of it might be sin, but like that's not the sin that got God so hacked off.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not that the seed spilling on the ground angers God. It's the fact that he refused to do what his duty was. I mean, he was motivated by envy, and so he wanted what was not going to be his if he fathered children. So he was not showing compassion toward Tamar. He was acting out of envy.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he was willing to have sex but not willing to,
right?
Like,
yeah,
have that outcome. That's the real problem here.
Yeah, he was just using Tamar in the same way, as we'll see in a minute, that his dad used her. They were both using Tamar just for sexual purposes. That's it. I mean, she was basically no better than a prostitute to Onan. So God took his life. Two sons down. Yeah, one more to go. So what's Judah going to do? He's lost his firstborn. He's lost his secondborn. So, I mean, he is obligated to give Tamar now to his third and his youngest son, Shelah. But here's what he does instead. He says, then Judah said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. And then we're told what he was really thinking, for he thought, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers. So it's like Judah is blaming Tamar here, right? Yeah, this chick is cursed. I mean, it can't be that my sons did something wrong. It's obviously got to be my daughter-in-law's fault. That's what he's thinking. So he's basically, he has no intention whatsoever, of course, of giving Tamar to Shelah. He's buying time. That's all he's doing. So he sends her back to live with her parents. So that's where we are so far in the story. So two sons dead, Tamar still without any children, and now she's twice widowed, sent to live with her mom and dad again. Now this is bad on Judah's part, because once a woman marries into a household, it is the household's responsibility to care for her. I mean, that's the reason you have a levirate marriage to begin with. So he's basically just kind of pushing her away. You know, you're sure you married into our family, but you're not part of our family now. Just go back to mom and dad, and I'll send for you when the time is right, when my son grows up. So he's already acting deceitfully. He's acting selfishly. He's not concerned about her. He's only concerned about himself. So here's what happens next. It gets more exciting as we go along here. So some time goes by, and it turns out that Judah himself ends up as a widower. His wife dies, the daughter of Shua that he had married. And when the time of mourning was ended, he goes up to see his sheep shears at a place called Timnah to take care of the sheep there. And this is when Tamar, and perhaps her family too, gets pretty tricky here. I say her family too because I'm kind of following a suggestion of Luther here. Luther thinks that Tamar was not the only one who was involved in the little trick that's about to take place. He thinks that actually her family was involved in this too, at least in the second part of it. We don't know for sure, but somebody told Tamar that Judah was going to be taking this trip, where he was going to be, and so she concocted a plan. Here's what she does. She'd been wearing the traditional garments of a widow, so she takes those off, and she covers herself with some sort of veil. Not exactly sure the Hebrew word there, but some sort of covering, some sort of veil. Anyway, her face could not be seen. She wraps herself up, and she goes, and she sits in a gateway, which is kind of at the crossroads where Judah is going to be traveling. And we have this note added at the end of verse 14, which says, "For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife." So maybe when Judah first sent her away, she thought, okay, well, whenever his youngest son has grown up, is ready for marriage, and he'll send for me. But now she realizes it was all a ruse. Judah never intended to give her to his youngest son. Then Judah sees her. When he saw her, he thought that she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. I guess whatever prostitutes looked like back then, she had on all the regalia of a prostitute. Or maybe it's the place she was at. We don't know. But anyway, when Judah sees her, he's convinced that she's a hooker. So he turns aside to her by the road and said, he's such a sweet talker, "Here now, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law.
That's an Old Testament line that has definitely gone the way of the buffalo. That doesn't work nowadays, I don't think.
No, you know, as far as pickup lines go, it probably won't get you very far.
I mean, even a prostitute might turn you down if you roll that one out. Like, what?
What? Drive on, buddy.
Weirdo.
Yeah, he's so blunt. And yeah, you got to think about what's going on with Judah here too. I mean, this is the not the first, but the the second or third of the various sins that are ascribed to Judah here. I mean, first of all, how did she know this was going to work? I mean, was Judah known for hanging out with prostitutes? I mean, just because she dresses up like a prostitute does not guarantee that when her father-in-law walks by, he's going to say, "Oh, there's a prostitute. I'm going to have sex with her." Right? There's no guarantee this is going to happen, but maybe she knows a little bit more about him than we know.
She might have assumed because his wife was gone that, hey, he'll probably be up for that.
Have certain urges. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe so. Maybe so. Whatever the motivation was, he certainly is not very hesitant about paying for the services of a prostitute. So what happens after this is they kind of go through this haggling process. He says, "Hey, let me come into you." And she says, basically, "What are you going to give me that you may come into me? How much are you going to pay me, in other words, for sex?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, how about I give you a baby goat from the flock?" And we assume that
also
was
something that doesn't work nowadays. This is not a relevant story.
Yeah. This is not a relevant story. This is not the way it works today. Yeah,
I'm imagining that this is like Dwight from The Office. If anybody knows that reference,
Dwight would be the one. Yeah,
I'll send like Dwight.
I'll send you goat and some beets. I'll send you some beets. Right. Yeah. And he would fully assume that she would just be, "Yeah, great. Yeah, everybody loves beets and goats." reading Genesis with The Office. Yeah. An interpretive method. So she says, presumably that's fine with her. Okay. She says, "But you know, you don't have a goat with you. So what will you pledge? What are you going to give me as a pledge until you send me the goat?" This is almost comical, this kind of back and forth going on between them. And he says, "Well, what do you want? Right? What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Well, you have your seal, which is kind of like probably a cylindrical seal that was personalized in some way. You got to roll it on clay or wax, and that would be basically your signature. So you get your seal and your cord, and you've got that staff or that scepter that's in your hand." So he gives them to her, and he went into her, and she conceived by him. It just kind of throws it out there. So he gives her the pledge. They have sex, and she conceives. This would basically be like Judah, you know, handing over his driver's license and car keys or something. You know, here you go. I'm going to give these to you, and then I'll send you a goat later. We'll get those back. That was the plan, anyway. So he leaves, takes off, going to wherever he was heading to, where the sheep shears were. She gets up, and she leaves. Takes her veil off, puts her widow's garments all the way back on. So Judah gets where he's going, and he tells his friend what happened, and he sends his friend with this goat. He had to go back himself. He sends a friend with a goat, and the friend gets back there, and he can't find her. So he asks the men of the place, "Hey, where's the temple prostitute who was by the road?" And these guys say, "There aren't many temple prostitutes here." So he goes back to Judah and says, "Hey, I couldn't find her. And the men who were around there said there's been no temple prostitute here." So Judah says, "Well, fine. She can just keep my seal and my staff. Otherwise, we're going to become a laughing stock. I sent the kid. I fulfilled my part of the bargain, and you didn't find her." Now, one little note here that I think is interesting. We had two different Hebrew words going on here because it says she dressed up like a harlot, which is the regular word for prostitute. But when he sends his friend back, he says, "Hey, it was a temple prostitute that I had sex with." It's almost like Judah is embarrassed to admit that it was just a regular prostitute. But no, it was this was like a holy prostitute, right? This was a temple prostitute that I went into. So go back and pay her with this goat. So Judas keeps digging himself a deeper hole here, because it'd be one thing for him to have sex with a regular prostitute, but no, it's got to be a, a sacral prostitute. So basically, not only is he fornicating, he's also engaging in idolatry by participating in these sacred rituals of the idolatrous religions of that time. So that's the story so far. So what's going to happen next? Came about 3 months passed, and Judah finds out that his daughter-in-law played the harlot. It says it was he was informed. We don't know who told him this. This is where Luther thinks that Tamar's family is in on it, and that they tell Judah, they make up a story, and they tell Judah that she played the harlot. They're setting him up, in other words. Whether that's true or not, somebody tells Judah what...
played the harlot is an interesting turn of phrase there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is an interesting turn of phrase. Yeah, so that's exactly what she did. She did play the harlot. She wasn't so much the harlot, but yeah, she played the harlot. That's a good point. It's a good turn of phrase there. And she's with child by harlotry. Now, Judah's response is classic. I don't know what you want to call it. Holier-than-thou response. Bring her out, he says, and let her be burned.
I just want to say that I got some Judas in my life.
Bring her out and let her be burned. We're not going to talk to her first. We're not going to find out, you know, if this is the truth. We're not going to show any compassion because, you know, she does happen to be pregnant. So you're going to kill her and the child and you're going to burn them? Oh, boy. I tell you.
Give that dude the blessing. This dude is awesome.
Yeah. Give Judah the blessing. I mean, Simeon and Levi, they don't deserve it because they murdered to defend their sister. And obviously Reuben didn't because he had sex with his dad's concubine. But Judah, he is a pillar of piety. He is a shining star of righteousness, and let her be burned. So he utters this announcement as if he himself is blameless and innocent and the best judge of what should be done. Burning, by the way, was reserved in ancient Israel only for a couple of very specific cases. One, if a guy married a woman and her mother, so which I can't imagine marrying your wife and your mother-in-law. But anyway, so that the penalty then was burning, death by burning. Or if the daughter of a priest committed harlotry, then she was to be burned. Only two instances. Otherwise, everyone was just stoned if they were executed. So that's what Judah pronounces. Bring her, let her out and let her be burned. And I just have to read this because if I don't read this, then you don't catch the full flavor of the story. Verse 25. And it was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, I am with child by the man to whom these belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. And Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah. So Judah's caught. What else is he going to say, right? This is like a Nathan David moment here. Nathan tells that story about the mean king who took this precious lamb that was, you know, meant so much to this other poor man. And what does David say? That dude deserves to die.
Yeah.
And Nathan's like, you are the man. Well, this is the you are the man moment in Judah's life. I can picture this whole thing happening. It's almost like Tamar is totally calm. She says, before you burn me here, show these to Judah and let him know that these belong to the father of the child that I'm carrying. And you can see Judah's eye just widen with realization as he sees his own signet ring and his own staff and his own cord shown to him.
Well, the positive part in this is that instead of like trying to figure out a plan to like get rid of that stuff or something and get her burned even quicker, like there, at least you do have a semblance of repentance here, where it's like, okay.
Yeah,
I mean, to say that she's more righteous than I is to say that I'm not righteous at all.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, his response, just like David's response, is the response that God desires. He doesn't try and shift blame anymore. You know, he doesn't say, "Well, you know, okay, I'm the dad, but let me tell you what she did." Right? He just simply says, "Hey, she's more righteous than I. I'm the unrighteous one here." David says, "You know what? I have sinned against the Lord." So this is right. This is repentance. It's claiming no righteousness of our own, throwing ourselves completely upon the mercy of God. So let me kind of move ahead here. We've only got about 3 minutes left here. So it tells us he didn't have any more relations with her. All right. She is pregnant, and when the time of birth came, we find out that she was actually pregnant with twins. So while they were being born, a hand exits the womb, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand and said this one came out first. But he pulls his hand back, and his brother comes out first, and she says, "What a breach you have made for yourself." And so he was named Perez, which means breach. And then his brother was born with a scarlet thread in his hand, and he was named Zerah. So let's ask the bigger question in the little bit of time that we have left. You know, what's most amazing about this story? Well, I think the most amazing part is that when you turn to the first chapter of Matthew and you're reading this genealogy, that it says, you know, to Isaac was born Jacob, to Jacob, Judah, and his brothers. To Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And then it goes on. So in the genealogy of our Lord, you have incest. You've got this union between a father-in-law and his daughter-in-law. You've got this, you know, make-believe prostitution. You've got lust, lies, deceit. All of this pollution of sin that is in the genealogy of Christ, which is exactly why Christ came. He assumed the humanity that had been polluted by every imaginable sin that's under heaven. No, that's in order that he might redeem us from it.
Yeah, that's exactly what the genealogy of Jesus is there for, is to show you exactly what kinds of sins he came to assume. He literally comes as a descendant from a long line of horrific sin, the worst of sins, the sins that we think are far and away most taboo, and they're all there present in his line. He comes and assumes them all, takes them all on himself. You know, a lot of the old church fathers talk about the incarnation a little more strongly than a lot than we do now, as far as, you know, you put a ton of emphasis on the cross, and rightly so, but the incarnation is where God becomes man and assumes all of humanity to himself, right? He joins himself with all of humanity, and you look at his lineage and you see that he's gathering up all these sins to take to the cross. And so that line and what's going on there and the incarnation is just, I mean, I think it's obviously indispensable, but sometimes we don't view the incarnation there. It's just sort of this Mary scene with this manger and this baby, but there's more going on there. There is the joining yourself with all of humanity that God does.
Yeah, the incarnation, his taking on our humanity, is his taking on every Old Testament story that we've looked at, that we will look at, that's just full of everything from lust to greed to hatred to murder. It's all in the flesh. It's all in the flesh of the genealogy of Christ, which is precisely why he came. He came to assume what is ours in order that he might redeem it, make it his own, and unite us to his own holy body, and in that way to save us and give us the promise of resurrection.
That is it, and we're out of time. That's a good way to end a very horrific probably the episode that somebody may turn off halfway through. But if you didn't turn it off because your kids were in the car with you, you should know that Christville Fast is listener-supported stuff. If you like this podcast, the articles, the conferences, other podcasts that we do, you can support us by going over to christholdfast.org/support, and you can make a donation one time or reoccurring. Thank you so much to those of you who have done that. That's why we're able to keep doing this. Also, conferences coming up. One in New York, June 11th. That is very soon. You can be there. It's a one-day event. If you're in the New York area, come on down and hang out with us. We'd love to see you. And then October 29th in Dallas, Texas, if you are down in the South. So check those things out. There's more information at ChristHoldFast.org. And we will see you guys next week.